I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/spoken today.
This is a paid advertisement from BetterHelp. As a podcast listener, you've heard from us before. Today, let's hear from our members about what online therapy has done for them.
I would recommend my therapist 1,000 times over. She has truly changed my life.
The day after my first session, my friends and family said I sounded like myself again for the first time in weeks.
You deserve to invest in your well-being. Visit BetterHelp.com to see what it can do for you. That's better, H-E-L-P.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives. Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to our 100th episode of Preconceived. I started Preconceived 2 years ago with the idea of exploring the preconceptions that shape our lives, challenging the linear paths that many of our lives take. Growing up in a nuclear family, going to elementary, high school, and then college, exploring romantic relationships while we're younger, and then settling down in our 20s or 30s in a monogamous relationship that usually conforms to the romantic Hollywood vision of love, honing in on a profession and focusing on making money, having kids and then exposing them to a fairly similar path to the one that you had followed when you were younger, continuing with your mostly 9-to-5 job, with weekends and a few vacations sprinkled in between. And then, as we get older, retiring blissfully, stepping away from our once active lives, enjoying our grandkids maybe, and perhaps thinking that our best days are behind us. On the first episode of Preconceived over 2 years ago, I spoke with my mom, Robin Mednick. It was about this very path I've described above, and her unconventional journey through life that at times did, but at many times didn't conform to the status quo. The episode was titled Jump In, as that was a mantra that has always inspired her to follow her intuition and veer from the preordained path, so to speak, when that is what felt most authentic to her. The idea of jumping in is about embracing the unknown, plunging into the most seemingly random adventures, and keeping an open mind to the opportunities that life throws our way. Jump in is a concept that she has instilled in me, and I very much felt when launching this podcast like I was jumping in. Not like starting a podcast is some transformational idea or anything, but for me, it was a new chapter, and it was an area in which I didn't particularly feel qualified to engage. For this 100th episode of Preconceived, I thought it fitting to have my mom back on the show to further delve into this idea of jumping in by honing in on one of her most meaningful journeys in life, the creation of the charitable organization Pencils for Kids. Through her 15-year-long journey with Pencils for Kids, I've seen her learn so many lessons about life, welcoming fear, embracing change, and diving into the unknown. So, Mom, I think that's the longest introduction I've ever done in 100 episodes. Welcome to the 100th episode of Preconceived.
That was great. Thanks, Dale. Thanks for having me on such a special time.
It's pretty wild that we recorded our first episode It was over a couple of years ago, and a lot of people really liked that episode. Not to toot your horn, and you're going to say some self-effacing comment now because you don't accept praise, but a lot of people really liked that.
I'm glad. Thank you.
In this notion of jump in, why don't you tell people listening to this, how did Pencils for Kids start? What is Pencils for Kids? And tell people about the beginnings of that journey.
So it was 2005 in December. And at the time I was producing a radio show. And I was also very much involved with the Olympics and Commonwealth Games as a volunteer. And I was headed over to Melbourne for the Commonwealth Games. And I was working with a videographer, Dan Galbraith, and he called me up and he said, hello. And I listened to his voice and I could hear that something was wrong. And I asked him, you know, what the matter was. And he said he just returned from the Games of La Francophonie in Niger, West Africa. I didn't know what they were, but they're games of sport and culture every 4 years among the French countries of the world. And he said that he couldn't function since he was back because they were held in Niger. And a colleague of his went to visit a school and 30 children were sharing one pencil.
Where is Niger? Because I have a feeling a lot of people haven't even heard of Niger.
I hadn't heard of Niger. It's a landlocked country. It's in West Africa. It has over 20 million people. And it is, by all accounts, and by the United Nations Development Index, considered the poorest country in the world, dead last in 2020. So he described this to me, and I honestly don't know what it was about that moment, but when I heard 30 kids sharing a pencil, I just instinctively said, you know, and I heard his pain. I said, Dan, stop talking. Let's just do something. And he said on the phone, well, what are we going to do? I said, I have no idea. I'll call you back. So we hung up. I called the Canadian government in Ottawa. I asked for a phone number for the embassy in Niger. I got one. I called up. And of course, it just hit me. It's Francophone Games. It's a French country. They answered me in French and they didn't speak any English. But I managed to ask them if I could. All I was thinking of, I'll do something small. Let me send pencils. And could I send them to you? And they said, no, we're an embassy. And so you can't send anything, but we'll find you somebody. So they sent me an email, a letter entirely in French. And in the email, there was the name of a person, Amadou Madougou. And I called him up right away. And of course, he didn't speak a word of English, but he managed to convey to me that I should call back that night at 7 o'clock, which I did. I called at 7 and his son Mahmoud answered the phone. And I said to Mahmoud, who is your dad? I didn't even know why the embassy had recommended this man. Who is your dad and what does he need? And he said his father was the mayor of a commune called Libore. And he used to be the minister of education for the entire country years earlier. And I said, well, can you send me his wish list, you know, for his community? I didn't even know what a commune was, but it covered many, many villages. And so that was the next thing that happened. An email came back to me and it had everything you can imagine, pens, paper, rulers, notebooks, everything. And then I got scared. I thought, what am I doing? All of a sudden, this community that I do not know, have never heard of, is sending me a list of so many things. So I got in my car and I drove to my local Office Depot and I walked in the door and I asked to speak to the manager. And a man came out. This was just before, just after New Year's, I think, or around New Year's. And the man came out and I said, he introduced himself as Michael. And I said, hey, Michael, you don't know me, but there's a country far away. I don't know anything about it, but there's 30 children there sharing one pencil in the classroom. Can you help me? And he said, I decided this year it wasn't going to be about me. I want to join your team. So he clearly made a New Year's resolution. And I said to him, Michael, I don't have a team, but you're on it. And so Michael, you're laughing. I think I might have been laughing at the time too. So Michael actually took me up and down the aisles of Office Depot with this cart. Remember, he didn't know me. I had no idea that he had asked for. And then we started figuring out together what could they possibly want. And we took the list and other things we thought would be valuable. And we went up and down the aisles. There were a few things that he didn't have in particular that we thought might be useful. So after leaving Michael, new member of the team, I drove my car down to my local Staples. And I walked in there and I asked for the manager, same thing. And she said, can you write me a letter of request? And I think I sat down at one of the computers at Staples and typed out a letter. Of course, we had no name, there was no charity. And I gave it to her. And she, I'll never forget this, she gave me $174 worth of supplies, free. What? Just gave them to me. And so then Michael and I, we had this box, and we didn't know, a box of supplies. We didn't know how to get it there. So I called Mahmoud, the mayor's son, and I asked Mahmoud, how am I going to get this to you? And he said, well, the company that they trust is DHL. So I immediately called DHL, the normal route, you know, dialed the number, asked if they do charitable donations, deliveries. And they said I wasn't qualifying or they couldn't do it. And then I thought, after trying that route, that I did what I'd always learned you're supposed to do, and that was get in touch with the president of DHL. And even getting the phone number, my brother-in-law helped me, even finding the phone number of the office of the president of DHL was not a simple thing, but I managed to find it, and I faxed a letter. Those were the days of faxes. So I faxed a letter to the president of DHL, just explaining there were 30 kids in the class, could you send this one box? Eventually, I might want to send more things. And the letter went off, no answer for a day, 2 days. And then I got a phone call. And then the phone call was from the executive assistant to the president of DHL. And she said, did someone there fax us a letter? And I got so excited. I said, yes, it was me. And then she said, we didn't get the letter. We got the fax cover sheet, which, as you know, only says pages including cover two. It didn't say anything about what was in the letter.
I'm impressed they followed up.
I was so impressed. And it's the story of DHL. They are a remarkable organization. So I said to her, please don't hang up. And I told her the story on the phone. I said, I don't know what I'm doing, but there's 30 kids sharing a pencil in this community. We've gathered some supplies. They trust you. Do you think you could send over this one box? And maybe later a bit more, because I was finding out by now there were over 3,000 students in the community. And she said, I'll call you back. She called me back almost right away. She spoke to the president. She asked him if we could do this. And he also asked her thoughts. And I think she liked the idea. And so they said, yes, they would do it. I wasn't sure if they were just going to send that one box, that we called it a test box. Would it get there? Is it what they needed? Or whether she'd eventually send more. But at that point, I was so excited. So DHL, I didn't want to bother them. This was my, you know, DHL picks it up at your home. It's a, right? But I didn't want to bother them to do that. So I drove it out to the airport, to their main office. They sent it by air. It arrived only a few days later in Labore, the community where this Amadou Madougou was the mayor. And he got it. And then he called the Canadian embassy to witness the opening of that box. And that just spoke volumes to me. I thought, wow, there's something just so honest about that. So they opened it and he said, yes, the pencils you sent are great, but mechanical pencils are not as good. The children will break them. And they went through a bunch of stuff. And then the next thing I knew, Michael from Office Depot came up with four more boxes of school bags with all kinds of supplies in them. And I nervously called DHL. They said they would do it. I drove them out to the airport and we sent them off Air Express, and DHL was amazing. And now the mayor didn't know what to do because he had 100 school bags, 3,000 students. So he called a ceremony in the entire village, brought everyone together and awarded the top earning students, each of them a school bag, and sent me a little video. And they filmed it for national television in the country of Niger. And then, of course, this spurred all of the people who knew me. What are you doing, Robin? I said, I don't know, but we're collecting supplies for this community we've never met. And now I have 24 boxes in my basement. And I nervously called DHL. Were they going to send 24 boxes, Air Express? And they said they would, but I still didn't want to bother them to pick it up at my home. So I packaged them all up. I hired a moving van, and I took the moving van all the way out to the airport, and I labeled them all. We shipped them all over. And then the mayor said, we got them, but you must come in person to open them. We're not opening them till you come here personally.
How long had this been going on for at this point?
this was going on for a while because my first trip wasn't until May of 2007. And the first phone call was in end of December 2005. So it had been going on about a year.
How surprised were you when you went to Office Depot and Staples that you encountered these people and at DHL who just said, yeah, sure, I like this, let's do it. I don't know you. You don't have a plan. no offense, but you don't really have a strong plan. You're not a charitable organization. How surprised were you that they did embrace that? What did you find with those first few encounters of people that surprised you?
Well, I think shock would be a good word. If I look back now on the reactions of everybody, I mean, I'm a very spiritual person. And sometimes I think things sometimes happen for a reason. Maybe the timing was certainly right with Michael, because he had just been on his own journey and decided in a moment of New Year's resolution that this year was going to be about seeing what he could do. I'm sure he was a helper before that, but it was timing. It was luck in that sense. But I mean, DHL coming through the way they did, they get requests all the time. Staples, the manager, just saying, when I look back now, I think, how did that happen? But maybe they were, I think sometimes it's the story. The story of 30 kids sharing one pencil is, why did it grab me? I mean, if you visualize that, it's just almost hard. Who in what country can't imagine kids in a classroom not even being able to have a pencil? And yet it happens to hundreds of millions of people around the world, but in our world, it's not something we think about. We don't see that in our classrooms. And so I think that's what hit me. How can we not react to that visual, that story? I think sometimes it's the story that grabs us. And that particular story that Dan related with his heartbreak really grabbed me by the throat. And I think it grabbed them.
So they've then invited you to come to Libore, Niger. So what spawns you to go there? Was there any trepidation?
Well, there was lots of trepidation. I don't think at the time there were travel advisories not to travel to Niger. Now, of course, and since that trip, it's like the government advises you never to go there at all. But
and you're not talking just COVID. You're talking because of violence there.
Oh, violence, terrorism, worry, safety, all of those reasons. So I was nervous. I didn't speak the language, had never met any of them. We weren't doing Zoom or anything like that. Very apprehensive. But my daughter, your sister, Sam, was working as a journalist in Ghana. So I called Sam. I said, okay, Sam, you're working right next door to Niger. It's the country, it abuts Niger. So will you be my journalist on the ground? I'm going to pick you up in Ghana. So I flew to Ghana. And believe it or not, even though they are right next door to each other, it took us four small flights to get to Niger. And on one of those flights, it was a little airplane. There was a man sitting beside me. We introduced ourselves. His name was Peter. He was from United Kingdom. And he said, and he was going to Ivory Coast, I think. He said, Robin, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to Niger. He said, why are you going to Niger? Nobody goes to Niger. And I told him the story of, by this time, the little group of us volunteers were calling ourselves, although we were not a business, a charity or anything, calling ourselves Pencils for Kids. And I told him about the story and we had a lovely conversation. When he went to get off the plane, he took out of his pocket $100 US and gave it to me. I said, Peter, don't give me your money. I said, you don't know me and I don't know what I'm doing and we're not a charity. And he said, no, Robin, I trust you. Just put it where you think it will do some good. So I had this $100 in my pocket. I get off the plane. Sam and I are met by this entourage of people. Only one person speaks English and that's Mahmoud, Amadou's son. So they're at the airport, they take us to the hotel, they explain our itinerary for the next, I think we were there almost a week. And then the next day, he takes me to one of the villages where I'm introduced to men, women, and children, and national television is there. And the 24 boxes I have sent are sitting there in a room. And my job in front of TV is to open those boxes, to take out, and I'm holding one up, a notebook and a school bag, and to hand out one to the students that have been chosen to come in front of me and who've maybe had the top marks, and to give them one of these notebooks and school bags. And in front of television, and I was thinking, you, your siblings, and the people in our country, they go through notebooks, so many of them, in any given year for any given course. And this was the first time any of these students had ever had a notebook of their own. It really moved me. And particularly the girls, because the girls were not really advancing in the education system there. And through the time when I was there, they told me all of the problems that they were facing with so many things. No electricity, no running water in most places, no generators, poverty, the likes of which I had never seen, food insecurity. And my head was swimming because we had not yet decided even what we were going to do with Pencils for Kids. What was our focus? So I had decided before I left to go to Niger that the Canadian embassy might have some local money in Niger. I called them. I made a meeting with them. I brought the mayor and his entourage there. The ambassador at the time looked at me and he said, "The fact that you came means so much, but the meeting will be entirely in French." And then he proceeded to explain to the mayor that they had some local money that the mayor could apply for, but the deadline for schools to money for school was up in a few weeks, but they could apply after that for money for fencing, for security, for other things. And when we got out of the meeting, I said to the mayor through a translator, I think his son, I said, "Listen to me, there's 3 weeks left before you can apply for money for a school. Get that application in, because you don't know." And the following day, not knowing if we'd ever get any money, the mayor took me to one of these villages in a remote area. And the men were there, the women and children, and three plush chairs in the middle of this desert. I was on one, the mayor was on the next, and the chief of the village was on the other one. And the mayor explained to the chief of the village in his local language of Zarma that I had come to build a school.
Had you?
No, I had come with the purpose of figuring out who they are. What am I doing? What do they need? And we didn't know if we'd ever have money. We hadn't raised a dollar. I had only that $100 in my pocket from Peter. And then the mayor stood up and in French explained to me while Sam was filming. He stood up and he walked 10 paces in the desert and he said, "Madame Mednick, do you want the school over there," pointing to a barren area of desert? And then he walked 10 paces the other direction, pointing to another area of the desert. And he said, "Or do you want the school over there?" And I remember looking with wide eyes into Sam's camera and saying, "Monsieur le maire, please put the school wherever you want," not knowing if we would ever raise a dime. And on the way home at the airport, before we left, I took that $100 from my pocket and I gave it to the mayor. And I said, "This is from a man I met on an airplane that I don't really know, from England, but I want you to take this money." And he looked at me, the mayor, and he said in French, "We will engrave that man's name on the first desk in the first school that we build together." And I went home. I immediately emailed Peter, whose email I had thankfully taken. I said, "Peter, you're not going to believe this." He said, "Robin, you're not going to believe this, but I've told a lot of my colleagues in England about you, and we are going to raise money for you. One of them is about to climb Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania, and he's going to go and climb." I said, "If he's going to climb, tell him to take a little picture that says Pencils for Kids and hold it at the summit and take a picture of himself so that one day, if we ever build this school, we will frame his picture and we will tell the kids that they can accomplish anything they want if they have the willingness to try." And 3 weeks later, the mayor applied for that money for that school. The Canadian Embassy granted $69,000 for the building of the first school. The people in England sent over a check for over $3,000. And the school was built, and we went back for our second trip to officially open it in November of 2007, a short 5-6 months after our very first visit. And there on the wall was a picture of Peter handing me the $100, a picture of Marcello at the top of Kilimanjaro holding a little sign that said Pencils for Kids, and a desk engraved with Peter's name, just as the mayor had promised a few months earlier in the airport.
Yeah, I mean, it's inspiring to hear that. When you're talking about building a school there, What does that mean? What does this mean for the kids there? What are they doing before the school?
This was in Ulmantama village. They had never been to school. This is a village where children did not go to school. Don't picture a big, gigantic structure like we might see in North America. Picture a cement classroom with three rooms and like not windows with glass, but openings. No electricity or air conditioning, anything like that. But desks and a blackboard, a teacher supplied by the government. Build the school, the teacher will be supplied. We supplied books. And this is the first time ever that these children were able to go to school. That was in 2007. We're now in 2021. Children have been going to that school for the past 14 years. And now there are now straw hangers outside the school because they've exploded with growth since that time. And Ulmantama has had children from that school graduate from primary, because it's a primary school, went up to grade 6. And some of those students have gone on to college, which is their version of junior high. Some of them have made it over to secondary. So it's extraordinary what that one first school did for that community of Ulmantama.
And how many schools have you guys built since? And what has the long-term impact been on these kids? Has it changed the trajectory of some of their lives?
Yes. I mean, it's changed. It's definitely changed the trajectory of their lives, because every year of education in the life of a child there, or a girl, really improves the life of her family every single year, because the illiteracy rate is very, very high in Niger. So even if they don't make it all the way to junior high or all the way to high school, every year makes a difference in what they know and the world around them. What we've done since then, I mean, in the past 14 years, we've built 2 more schools. We've started 14 kindergartens. There was no such thing as a kindergarten. So think of all of the 3 to 5 year olds who were at home. Think of all the girls primarily who could have gone to school, but were not going to school because they were required to stay home to look after the 3 to 5 year olds. We started a scholarships for girls program to get girls to stay in school, providing extra tutoring, money, food allowances to get girls to stay in school in junior high and on to high school. No girls had gone to high school ever in this community of Labore. Today, 39 girls have not only gone to school, there's hundreds more. We've given over 500 scholarships, but 39 are now in university or postgraduate institutes. Our first veterinarian graduated only this past year. Now, we didn't sponsor her veterinarian school, but we got her through the critical few years of junior high to get her to that place. So through education, and then through all of that, we realized some girls just simply were not going to make it in school. So we started a sewing center to give them a trade, so those girls wouldn't be lost and could somehow find a skill to make their lives better. And we started a sewing center affiliated with the National Center of the Country. It's a 3-year program. It's self-sustaining because the girls have to pay tuition to go in. And then we fell into a farming program quite accidentally, which has become the biggest program that we have embarked on yet.
And what's the nature of that?
There was an incredible man living in Niger who was Israeli. His name was Dov Pasternak. He had been the head of Ben-Gurion University and in biology and well-renowned for even introducing drip irrigation to the country and helping green the desert through finding water under the ground. He lived in Niger, and he wanted to help the Nigerian people, the farmers, find water in the desert. And I heard about him, I met him, and I decided to pilot his program. And we then started over the course with a fabulous NGO in New Jersey that Dove introduced me to, Eliminate Poverty Now. We started a joint effort over a decade ago to teach women in cooperatives how to create income-generating gardens and grow fruits and vegetables 12 months of the year Until then, they were waiting for the rain and only growing rain-fed crops 3 months of the year. They were getting enough to eat, to live, to subsist, but not enough to earn a living, not enough to buy anything else they wanted. So we started these 10 income-generating gardens in different parts of Niger, and the women have now been able, through that program, to be independent, to assist their families, to buy clothes, help with education, buy better homes. It's been a remarkable, remarkable program, which takes the bulk of the money that we now raise.
I'm almost a bit desensitized to it when you tell the story, and I'm sure listeners aren't, just because I've heard a lot of this over the past 15 years now. But as you explain it again now, it's just what strikes me is, how did you just do this? And I think that's what a lot of people are probably thinking. Once you entered and you realized, for example, in that moment, he said, okay, and she's going to build us a school. What were you feeling there when you hadn't been necessarily planning on building a school? There must have been fear. There must have been concern about, what am I doing? Am I getting in over my head? Who am I? I don't have any particular expertise in this area. I mean, we spoke on the initial podcast we did together about how you have a law degree, you went to Oxford, and you're a very well-educated woman, but you didn't particularly have any expertise in starting an NGO, in doing any of these things that you were actually embarking on. So what was your mind frame like, and what spawned you to move forward and actually continue with this, or initiate this?
It's a question that I think about all the time. So a couple things. Enormous fear. So I've been fearful the whole way through, but I'll talk about that in a sec. What really helped me at the beginning was the team of people that I built around me. And they were just people who were hearing the story in different places and said, oh, Robin, you know, I want to help with that. So this core group of incredible people who are still together to this day. And we didn't come together because, oh, we should represent that part of the country, or this person has connections and really good fundraise. No, we have no connections. We didn't come together with the typical corporate thoughtfulness that goes into, we should really, you know, govern and figure out what's the gap in our camaraderie. And we were a team motivated by the same thing. We're passionate about it. Let's help. Let's do something. So first of all, great, great people. I can't name them all because it would take long, but they are the core. Whenever I've felt down, I call one of them, both of them, all of them, nine of them, 10 of them. It's like a core of 10. So that's number one. Number two, they knew I was afraid. And my motto in life through this journey, and I would say if I looked back, it's sort of described my whole life, has been do it afraid. So I'm not a person who has no fear. In fact, I would say I'm more fearful than most people. I startle easily. I'm afraid of change. I am afraid of dying. I'm afraid of just so many things. So I think what motivated me through the fear was the notion that maybe I could help. And the feeling once I met the community. And that was the second piece. It's not just the people around me who were remarkable, but over 15 years, I've developed such a respect and trust because I do know their worth there. And Dove used to say, having lived there, physically living there for over a decade, they are the most gracious, most cultured people. And so I fell into the right place. And so despite the fear and worry, I was able to work my way through it. And I'll never forget sitting with my board of directors, my board at the very beginning, and they were trying to do the business plan. What's our five-year plan? And at the beginning, I didn't even know what my one-month plan was, let alone any five-year. And it came to the conclusion that I should be finding maybe $100,000 a year, maybe more. And I remember in that meeting, I'll never forget the feeling of panic. What do you mean you want me to raise $100,000? I don't even know where to get $10. We were just getting our charitable status. I was petrified, and I remember looking at everyone saying, I can't do this. I don't want you to put any expectations on me. I don't want any expectations. I'll do whatever I can with your help, but I don't if I can't raise it, we won't spend it. If we raise it, we'll spend it. I don't want to worry. I can't go into this worrying that I'll disappoint everybody in Canada, everybody in Niger, myself. Let's just go forward. And whatever happens, happens.
And I know one of your mantras is, in addition to do it afraid, one that's really stuck with you and that you've shared with me is abandon your expectations. So is that what helped you get over some of that fear and allow you to do it afraid?
Yeah, 100%. And actually, my favorite thing to say now, you'll love this, it's my one basketball analogy. it's really that moment when Kawhi Leonard hit the game-winning shot in the seventh game of the Raptors against Philadelphia. And there is a picture of Kawhi. He took an unbelievable shot and he sat crouched in the corner of the court and watched. And that's what the shot is. So he did everything he could throughout that whole game. He took the shot. It hit that rim four times. So he's watching. So he's given it his all. He's done everything he could. What's the point of worrying about expectations at that moment? Of course you want it to go in and you want to win, but it's not in your control anymore. And that's how I feel. I'm going to go out and I'm going to give it my best shot. I'm going to leave it all on the floor. And if it goes into that basket, fantastic. But if it fails for whatever reason, I can't look back and say I didn't try. And that's the way I look at everything with Niger, because there's way too many things that can go wrong for me to sit and worry every day about whether we're going to succeed in any of our programs.
I think that's a really reassuring and comforting thought for people just in life in general, that you put your best effort out there and you have to be outcome independent for many things in your life. You try your best, you do what you can, you start a business, you start an organization, you start a family, whatever it is, you have no idea what's going to happen. All you can do is put your best foot forward and say, I left it all out on the court, I guess to use that basketball analogy again, and then you kind of see what happens. But to judge yourself by what actually happens, it's a losing game, because at a certain point, there's no control there.
It's exactly right. And the other piece of it, sometimes you'll put your best effort out and sometimes you'll mess up. Your best effort might include, obviously will include, huge mistakes, which we have made through this process. And the other piece of advice, what do you do when you feel like you've messed up? And you've made amends. I mean, you've done your apologies or whatever, but sometimes you just learn to forgive yourself. So if you abandon your expectations, do your best shot, learn to forgive yourself in case things go wrong. I mean, that's what it's about. None of us is perfect. And we can't expect more of ourselves.
Even with that forgiveness example, you can ask somebody for forgiveness with the most genuine intentions and sincerity, but you can't control their response.
No.
So that's why it's so important to forgive yourself, because that's the one thing you can't control in that apology.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do you now define success?
Well, I can tell you it's no longer by the large things that we may or may not have done. A school, the first ever library in the community. But I now judge success by small things, because really it's the small things in life that I think make a difference. And I have kept this for over 12 years. And I don't know if you can see it, if those who are watching on the video, it's a little tiny torn piece of paper that one of the women in one of our garden programs gave to me one day. We didn't speak the same language, but she ran up and gave it to me. And it's her name, Asa Amadou, and then an equal sign, and then the word friend. And I've always kept this because it meant so much to me. The fact that she considered me her friend, to me, is a mark of success. I formed a bond of friendship with someone across an ocean, and maybe her life is a little better because of it, and certainly my life has been better because of it. And that, to me, is a mark of success, equally as important as anything we've built or started.
That's beautiful. This episode of the Preconceived Podcast is brought to you by Speaker Labs. Speaker Labs helps people become rockstar public speakers. Most people think public speaking is a unique skill that only a select few possess. At Speaker Labs, they disagree. To them, public speaking isn't a unique skill set. It's a unique context for a skill that all humans already possess, communication. If you can communicate, you can public speak. All you need to do is change the way you think. Speaker Labs will show you how. Visit courses.speakerlabs.ca and use the code PRECONCEIVED at checkout for 50% off of your lifetime access to Speaker Labs' brand new online course, The Lab. I've checked The Lab out, and I can tell you firsthand it is awesome, and it's helped me not only with presentations and public speaking in general, but even with this podcast. So I highly recommend you check this out and use the code PRECONCEIVED for 50% off. I want to talk about this idea of expertise, which I touched on before. What do you say to people who are embarking on any endeavor in life? You can get a degree now in pretty much everything. And I know when I spoke at the beginning of this podcast about the idea of starting this podcast, PRECONCEIVED, and I'm aware starting a podcast is not a revolutionary idea. There's almost a million podcasts out there. But I know that one of the things for me was, who am I to be starting a podcast? I could go to a course on podcasting. I could be a journalist. And there's people who start businesses who I'm sure think, well, I don't have an MBA, or I don't have a particular skill set that is academically certified for this task. How did you get past that? And what's your advice for people to getting past that, especially in a world where there is a course pretty much for everything? Are you glad that you just learned along the way a lot of this stuff? And you also depended on a lot of your previous knowledge and life experience, but are you happy that you just plunged in as opposed to saying, I'm going to take a year or so to do a course on international development, for example? And that's not to diminish people who do those courses. I just mean it can be very easy to get held up because there's always something more you can learn before you actually delve in.
No, look, it's true. So it's true that you can take a course on everything. It's also true that you can take many courses and that you're not sure if they've ever been valuable in your life. So yes, I went to law school, I studied politics and economics in England, and I used to wonder if anything I had done in any of the courses and the 10 years of education, if they really amounted to anything. And also the time I spent raising my children and being a mother and organizing my house. It wasn't until I started doing all of the work in Niger that I looked back and thought, you know what, the education I got growing up, the education in England, the way to think from law school, running the radio show, that all of those things started finding their voice. All the skills that I wasn't sure meant anything in, you know, in a particular purpose, they all sort of came together. And I think that every one of them has been useful in this journey. Would it have been helpful if I had a degree in it? Everything would be helpful, but I had to go with the moment. And the answer isn't always education in an academic setting. The answer is sometimes learning practically at the feet of the masters. So I didn't know a thing about agriculture, but I learned at Dov's knee. He was the visionary and he was so smart. And I've told you this all so many times, my favorite quote is from Ray Bradbury, the science fiction writer, who said, walk to the edge of the cliff, jump off and build your wings on the way down. And sometimes I know it goes against every corporate, you know, course that they have on business plans, you know, plan, 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 prepare, prepare, prepare. But sometimes, depending on the situation, you don't have that luxury. And I've always felt an urgency about a problem, particularly in Niger. Every day that I don't do something, a child is still working without a pencil, a notebook, you know, a woman still doesn't have the income she needs to generate for her family. And I felt the urgency. So doing and creating action meant more to me than studying more. I felt that I could surround myself by excellent people and they would help in figuring out the course of action, the programs we should do. And my job was to listen to them and fundraise and figure out where to go next. So you don't always have to create the plan, but obviously you have to be responsible, accountable, and figure it out as you go and surround yourself with great people.
Growing up, and I won't repeat the podcast we did before, and if anybody wants to listen to that, it's called Jump In. It's our first episode, so you can just scroll back 100 episodes. But
Listen to everyone on the way down.
Yeah, please listen to everyone on the way down. We talk about how you grew up, how you were obviously very educated, and then you had four kids, and you stayed at home as a stay-at-home mom. Then you gradually got back into volunteering, into the workplace. You became a tour guide. You became a radio show host. You worked for the Olympics. You worked for the Canadian Urban Institute. You did a lot of stuff. And I know that one thing that troubled you when I was growing up was your purpose in life. And were you fulfilling your purpose? What was your purpose? What were you working towards? How has this experience helped reshape what purpose means to you? Because I know that's something really important to you. And I know that it has helped shape the way you look at purpose and that you do feel a greater sense of purpose in your life than you once did.
Yeah, and I don't want to speak for anyone else because it's a very personal thing. But I used to describe myself when I was much younger as an advocate in search of a cause. Normally, you become an advocate after you found a cause and you fight for it. I knew I wanted to, that I wanted to fight for something, and I wanted to help somehow. That was my calling. I knew it when I was 14. I wanted to live up to whatever potential I was given. I never knew what potential it was and what it might look like, but I knew that I wanted to fight for something. And it wasn't until I was doing Niger for, I would say, a good year or two, maybe even more, that I sort of thought, wow, I've fallen into this. Maybe this is exactly what I've been driven to do, even though it was nothing that I ever looked for in this country, in this area of the world, in this career choice. So I never looked specifically for it. So in terms of purpose, some people, when they're born, they know exactly what they want to do. Other people just go about their lives and have fulfilling lives without necessarily being driven by one particular thing or another. And I think all of it is good, whatever, because we're all motivated differently. In fact, I usually use the analogy of DNA. DNA is usually what distinguishes us, right? One person is different in this way, not just the way they look, but in the way they think and their character. But I always think of DNA as something that we have in common. And the one thing of DNA that we all have in common is our humanity. And so rather than figuring out that we all need to find a purpose, I think the most important thing is that we all need to find the common humanity we have with each other. And that most of us in the world are driven to help each other and to give to each other. Despite the headlines that might say otherwise about the things that distinguish us, I think the thing that really drives us, most of us in the world, are the ways that we can make the world a better place and our lives better. I'm not sure that answered your question.
No, it did answer my question. And I know when I've had tougher moments during my life, and we've all had tougher moments, but I'm lucky you're my mom in those tougher moments, and always, I come to you and you always say to me, you know what? Go help somebody. Go do something. And I could be doing that a lot more in my life, giving. And whether that's in a charitable capacity or however it is, because it seems like that is one of the things that's really sustained you, the idea of helping people. And whether that's synonymous with purpose or whatever, it seems like that's really been at the core of your life.
At times in my life, when I've been down, it's allowed me to get out of my own problems and out of myself and out of my head. It's given me a sense of fulfillment. Sometimes I think I get more fulfillment from it than the people that I'm actually helping, because it really does make you feel that you've lived for a reason. And that's the way I feel about it. It's not something that I suggest to other people, that everybody should feel the same about it. But it is what sustains me, and I've learned that about myself.
So, Mom, looking back on the last 15 years, reflecting on what your organization has done, where do you see the next 10, 15 years going in Niger and in your work with Pencils for Kids?
Our big project going forward has come out of the work we've done in the farming program. We realized there aren't enough horticultural technicians. Those are technicians who teach how to grow fruits and vegetables with water from the ground. So there aren't enough technicians in the country. So over the past 10 years, and with Dov's leadership, and although he died 2 years ago, we are creating the biggest, most ambitious project we've ever done, which is a building called the Dov Center, which will be the first ever horticultural training school for technicians in the country. And we are in the process of fundraising, constructing, figuring out how that will look. And it's particularly exciting, but particularly daunting, because we live now in a world where West Africa is becoming increasingly dangerous. 100 villagers were murdered in the past month. Before that, 6 others were murdered, citizens who were from France. It is very dangerous in all of West Africa. Niger is facing that. I'm worried about it. We have always faced flooding, and this year was the worst flooding in 100 years in Niger. So despite all of those obstacles of terrorism, of insecurity, of safety, we are plowing ahead to create this first ever school. And I will still remember when I went for the opening of that very first school that we talked about at the beginning, Dad was by my side. And they opened the school, and then Dad and I had a meeting with the local eye doctors in the country, and they begged him to come back to do some training for eye doctors.
Because for those who obviously don't know, my dad's an eye doctor, just to give
Dad is an eye doctor, and they begged him to come back, and he managed a few years later to bring Orbis, an international organization with a flying eye hospital. And they were amazing. And they operated, they examined 400 people and operated on 95 people in our community of Labori and restored sight. It was an incredible thing that Dad did. But a few days after we left from that, there was a coup, a military coup. And just after we had left, and we couldn't go back to the country for the following year and a half or two because of that. So the dangers that we will face in the future are dangers we faced a little bit in the past, but they're getting worse. So the next 10 years, we will continue to fight through this. It's the most, according to UNICEF, the most underfunded humanitarian crisis in the world, and we're not leaving them. They are our friends, so we will stay as long as we can.
What do you say to the person who's listening to this, who's saying, wow, what an amazing woman, what an amazing story, but other people like her might be able to do this kind of thing, but not me? Whether it's about helping people or whether it's about anything in their lives, what do you say to that person to help them embark on that next journey that they think might be, quote, too big for them?
Well, take a closer look at me. I'm filled with fear, by my own admission. I have no degree in international development. I still do not speak French well, or I would say pretty much at all, just little bits. I'm in a country with a culture I still know very little about, although I'm learning. So what is extraordinary? The thing that helped me go was just my desire to do it. So if you have a desire to do it, that's all you need to have. And don't ever measure yourself by any other standard, but your passion to make change or to help someone. It doesn't have to be big. You don't have to know everything. Surround yourself by people who agree with you or care about you or care about the same cause that you do. And just do it, or do it afraid. Don't let anything stop you. And there's a great quote in a tiny little book that a friend of mine gave me once. And it says, don't accept the limitations of others who claim things are unchangeable or undoable. If it is written in stone, get out your hammer and chisel. And I've loved that. Anyone can do it.
Well, Mom, I'm so proud of you, and I've always been proud of you, but listening to your story in a way I haven't heard it in many years, it's inspiring, and I love you so much, and I'm so proud of everything that you've done, and I hope you know how special you are. So thank you for joining me on this.
Zale, I am, you talk about coming to me for advice, but I look to you so many times in my life for that inspiration and encouragement when I'm down. So I'm incredibly proud of you for getting to 100 podcasts in something that you weren't sure you could do out of the area of your own expertise. And look what you've managed to do, bringing so much interest and educational stories to so many people. So I'm very proud of you, and I'm really honored to be your 100th. And if it's possible, I'd love to end with my absolute favorite quote about...
You're my mom. You can do whatever you want on this podcast. Thank you for saying that.
This quote is something that I did not make up. I found it somewhere on the internet floating around. The pencil maker told the pencil 5 important lessons before putting him back in his pencil case. He said, "Everything you do will always leave a mark. You can always correct the mistakes you make. What is important is what is inside of you. In life, you will undergo painful sharpenings, which will only make you better. And to be the best pencil, you must allow yourself to be held and guided by the hand that holds you." Thank you, Zale.
I absolutely love that. Mom, where can people find out about Pencils for Kids if they want to learn more or get involved or donate in some capacity?
We are a fully volunteer organization with no paid staff. Our admin expenses are under 5% and often under 3%. If anyone wants to find us, we are at pencilsforkids.com. So that's pencils, forkids.com. Or I think we also have pencils with the number 4kids.com.
So if you're looking to experiment on the internet, you can try the FOR or the number 4. So an exciting activity for our listeners.
A COVID project. Very exciting.
Thank you, my mom, Robin Mednick, for joining me. It's been a pleasure.
Pleasure all mine.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to Preconceived. I say this at the end of every episode, but since it's our 100th, if you have been listening to these episodes and enjoying them, would really appreciate it if you rate and review us on whatever podcasting platform you use. It really, really does help with spreading the podcast to get new people to listen to it. And I read all the comments, and I love any feedback to help make the episodes more interesting and exciting. And I'm excited for another 100 episodes. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And have a great day.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Ever Googled your own name? Prepare for a shock, because your personal info, including addresses and phone numbers, is out there, especially with the recent hacks at some big phone and healthcare companies. But here's where Aura steps in. Aura scans the dark web for your sensitive information and sends real-time alerts. Aura also actively requests that your information be removed from data broker sites, putting you back in control. Aura provides you with a complete online safety toolkit, credit and transaction monitoring, a secure password manager, a privacy-enhancing VPN, parental controls, and more. Try Aura risk-free with a 14-day trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety. Rest easy with Aura. Visit aura.com/safety today.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
The Real Housewives is a guilty pleasure for most. But if you're looking to not feel guilty about that pleasure, tune in to Everything Iconic with me, Danny Pellegrino, where I break down all the messy moments and behind-the-scenes antics of Bravo's popular franchise. And on Everything Iconic, I also interview celebrity guests like Kelly Ripa, Keke Palmer, Drew Barrymore, Cameron Diaz, and more about their guilty pleasures, their past work, and so much more. So if you're pop culture obsessed and find yourself watching way too much reality TV like me, tune in to Everything Iconic with Danny Pellegrino, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.